This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antik. Back in February, 17 people were killed during a mass shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. What happened after that? Where student survivors organized themselves and mobilized others into a movement calling for tougher gun controls was what one journalist called courageous grieving. In the studio with me to tell me more about what that term means is Dr. Anasuya Jagadeesan, a counselor who specializes in grief counseling. Dr. Anasuya, thank you for being here and welcome.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So this is the first time I'm seeing the term courageous grieving in the media. Is it something new or has it always been in the literature, so to speak?
In the literature, it's new. In reality, it's one of the oldest things that we have. People, you don't have to have a tragedy to grieve courageously. People grieve courageously all the time. Usually, we always focus on those who are more damaged. We focus on the people who are more in pain and more openly in pain. And we don't talk about the people with a lot of resilience who don't show the pain and who grieve, but grieve in a matter, in a way which kind of uplifts the spirit of people around them. And that's what it is. And people have been doing that for centuries. Mm. But it's a new term in terms of terminology.
How was it described previously then?
Grieving.
Grieving, right. So that the term courageous is, does it mean that it's more public, that they're doing something about it, that maybe they're turning it into activism?
I would say in this case, it's very particularly turned into activism. But in terms of terminology, I have not honestly come across it in any way, means or forms in any of the media or any of the readings. And most of the readings do focus on people who grieve and who are grieving, who are in pain and who are unable to manage their lives. In mental health, when you are healthy, unfortunately, there's not as much focus on health, on, you know, how does health work? So this is an example of where, you know, an expansion or growth into the area of grief research probably needs to go, is how do people grieve and make grief into something beautiful?
Mm. So it's nothing different from what we conventionally understand as grieving.
To turn grief into a call for action, you know, when you look at history, even the first time people used a seatbelt was because a child went through a windscreen, and then people mobilized around the grief of the loss of a child. Historically, every event which causes pain, which causes tears, which causes fear, has drawn people together and motivated people to move and to make changes in society, in laws, where, you know, paper doesn't. When you have a call for action, when there's a face behind a pain, deaths of great people, deaths of children, Ryan White, when you're talking about AIDS, they become the face of the pain. And when you have these faces, people grieve for that individual, and then it mobilizes society. This is the first time that young people, so young, are doing it. And then it becomes something a bit more special in a way, because the young people were targeted. The young people are the victims, and then the young people are calling for action, and they're calling for very strategic action, because if you see the gun control laws in America, the NRA has a very simple policy. That's why they're very effective. No gun control, full stop. So anything, their whole policy is very straightforward. No gun control. Now, every other politician that's tried to go up against them, tries to mediate with them and all that, they have other agendas. So the other agendas overturn NRA's very straightforward, no gun control. Whereas these kids, they're like, it's not political. It's not about anything else. It's only about one thing, gun control. Now, I like, and some of them, the leader of it, he says, he's the son of somebody who uses guns. I think it's a CIA operative or something like that. And he's like, I have guns in the house. I'm okay with guns. But I don't want anybody to have a gun. Mm. So their message is also very straightforward. And that's why it's hitting NRA hard. Yeah. Because it's a counter message to NRA's message without any other agenda.
So this is not the first such mass shooting in America. It's not even the first one this year. Why do you think what they're doing has gathered so much media attention? Because I think people got a bit jaded or cynical after Sandy Hook, right, yeah. in 2012, when kids maybe as young as 3 or 4 years old are killed, yet nothing was able to move. But this time, it seems like something momentous is happening. I mean, the student survivors are going on TV, they are conducting town halls, they are even signing on to book deals now to tell or write about their experience. Why is this time different? I mean, journalists have used courageous grieving to kind of explain it, but you're saying it's nothing new. Why is this one different, you
think? Because it's the children. Because it is a call from the children. It is not motivated by politics. It is not motivated by anything else. This is the victims. It is young people saying, adults have failed, royally failed. You have not created a safe world. And, I mean, sad to say, this is not just in America. This is internationally. We may not have guns, but there are other issues here that perhaps we need to look at, even road safety. You know, and adults have failed in terms of ensuring our children are safe. And so now the children have to pick up the banner. And when they pick it up, and you have 11-year-olds speaking, articulating clearly, just protect us. Just say no to guns. Do not allow people to walk into our schools and buy guns, you know, assault rifles, for God's sakes. Give us some protection. It's hard to ignore. It is very easy to ignore politicians. It is very easy to ignore people with agendas. It is very hard to ignore the victims and try to turn it on the victims, because that was done. It was done by certain channels, which I won't mention, in the US, who tried to turn it on the victims and say the victims were being paid. The victims were being fed words. Mm-hmm. But when they speak, you can hear they're not being fed words. When they answer questions, they are answering questions. Nobody's giving them the answers. And that is the difference.
Do kids grieve differently compared to adults?
Depends on what's going on and depends on the exposure to grief. Children internalize and adults also internalize. Sometimes children can't find the words to say. Sometimes children, you know, have to use pictures rather than words. So grief in children, it is different depending on the level of understanding of the child. Like, how old a child are you talking about? You know, do children actually understand what death is? And the answer is yes, they do. And we underestimate them and we think they don't. And giving children fairy tales doesn't help. You know, the children find out the truth. I know people who say, don't tell them until later. And then after that, the children get very angry. And they find out that because what you've done is you've showed them that you can't trust, they can't trust you. Yeah. You lied to them. And they get upset about that. So then grief becomes a bit more complicated. So in terms of dealing with children, you have to be gentle. You have to manage a child's grief, but always with honesty. Right. You know, because kids, they feel it when people lie to them. And when they find out it's a lie, it's so much worse.
At what age, if there is such a threshold, would kids first understand the concept of death? And for a parent, how do you broach that topic?
What is actually said in the literature is that to broach it with kindness, to broach it gently, but to broach it. And there's no age limit. Because if you say, I'm hesitating to mention a parent, say a parent has gone, or let's just say a friend. Let's not make it so close. So a friend has gone. So if you go and tell a child a friend has gone, then in their heads, oh, okay, they've gone, they're coming back sometime. But then when you say a parent has gone, then they go, why? Is it my fault? And if it's not explained, then they may think it's their fault. So the conversation that needs to be had, it needs to be very gentle, yes. But don't lie about it. Because then, and padding it to the point where it's unrecognizable is not necessarily the best way to go. Mm. Especially in today's world where even a 4-year-old can swipe.
I want to pick up on another thing you said, which is that kids and adults internalize their grief sometimes when they can't articulate their thoughts. is it always better to communicate or speak to someone, or sometimes some people just prefer it to internalize when grieving?
Okay, let me put it this way. All of us internalize. And inside ourselves, if you can imagine, a container inside you where you've got emotions that you have basically tried to submerge. And it's a cup. Or it's a container. And the container is now full. One more drop and it overflows. It's not a big thing. It's a small drop. So when people internalize, and some people can internalize really well, the problem is not that you've internalized. The problem is that things keep happening in our lives and pain keeps building and new pain keeps coming in. And as new pain comes in, is there space inside you to hold the pain? Now, to externalize, it doesn't mean you have to talk to somebody. You can journal. You can write, you can sing, you can paint, you can dance, you can express yourself in any way, means or form to get it out so that there is more space inside you to accept new emotions. Because keeping in mind that as you are expanding this negative emotion, all these painful emotions, I don't use the word negative, painful emotions inside you, there's less and less space for joy. There's less and less space for love. There's less and less space for forgiveness. Because all these, you know, are internalized. They are, I'm in charge. I have to do this. I have to do that. The focus is on keeping that under check. And then what happens? There's no space. So internalizing is not necessarily wrong. I internalize quite a bit. But then later on, I find ways of managing and pouring out some of those emotions. And that doesn't mean I talk to people. And give me a break. I know most of the therapists in Malaysia, okay? It's very hard to talk to Malaysians. But I find other ways of internalizing. Of externalizing. Of helping those emotions come out of me.
I'm speaking today to psychologist Dr. Anasuya Jagadeesan about courageous grieving. Up next, I'll ask her about grieving in the public eye and what do we say or do around people who are grieving, and do we cause more harm if we are not careful? Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Trot Antic. My guest today is grief counsellor Dr. Anasuya Jagadeesan. We're talking about courageous grieving. This is in relation to how student survivors have responded in the aftermath of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. When reading about this news, I thought back to the case of our Facebook CEO, Sheryl Sandberg, back a few years ago when she wrote a book about coping with her husband's death. Mm-hmm. And before that book came to be, she wrote a post on Facebook that was shared very widely about how her husband, the circumstances around her husband's passing and how she coped with the logistics of dealing with her husband's funeral. What did you think of her book? Did it move the needle in what she said was her mission to, quote, change the conversation around adversity, end quote?
I think that's pretty courageous of anybody to choose to talk about that, especially publicly, about the passing of individuals, the passing of family members. And there are always going to be people who judge. There are always going to be people who look at it and say, oh, you know, you're doing this for money. You're doing this for... You know, why do you have to go and make a private thing public? Here's my answer. People grieve in different ways. People have different ways of expressing themselves. And who are we, as third parties, fourth parties, to sit down and sit in judgment of somebody else's grief? So for somebody to say they want to change the face of grieving, or they want to change the ethos of this time, people don't want to talk about death. There's still a big taboo. So kudos to people who come across and say, look, death is not a taboo. Death is as much a part of life as birth. If we don't have death, there'll be no reason for birth.
Is there a danger when someone as influential as her setting a norm on how people should grieve, and then those who don't feel that way or feel that they don't respond in a similar manner feel like something's wrong with them?
you know, no more than Michael Jackson's death or Robin Williams' death would create, you know, huge changes in how we view death. There are certain individuals, of course, who would be more influenced by, you know, death of media stars and movie stars because they feel a connection to that death, or they feel, you know, they feel the loss of that death. But very much you're not going to get, you know, public figures saying positive things about death is not going to influence people in negative ways. Public figures saying negative things about death, however, and I do believe we had a recent controversy on that one, that has, of course, a very big impact because we don't, like you mentioned, we don't know how people respond to that. And some people may rise in defense in a negative way.
Is there a connection between a person's resilience and how they grieve?
Yes, very, very strong connection between resilience and grief. Resilience basically means how we bounce back, how we are able to gather our resources. You know, maybe we crash. Maybe we do have a, you know, we go into depression. Maybe we do have a crash. But how long that crash lasts, how we bounce back, how we gather resources, how we get support and slowly come out of that dark place, that is resilience. Resilience is very much part of grief because as we grieve, we also heal. Resilience is the healing part in that process of grief. And in grief, both these processes work hand in hand. We grieve and we heal. Grieving actually supports healing. If, let's honestly say, if you are grieving and the reason why you're grieving and the reason why you're feeling pain, the reason why you're feeling inverted commas depression is because of grief. If you take a pill to stop feeling bad, when you stop taking the pill, the grief comes back. Because you still miss the individual that you love. You still are feeling the loss inside you. What you need, that process has to be there because we love that person. We don't grieve because we hate. We don't grieve because we're annoyed. We don't grieve because, you know, nothing like that. We grieve because we love and we miss someone. And taking a pill does not stop the loving and missing process. In fact, to a certain extent, it puts a buffer between your love for that person and you. And because behind the love is the pain and the loss. So when the buffer is reduced, you still miss the person. You still feel that pain. And the pain still comes back. So then the grief has to be managed. At one point or another, the grief has to be managed. And then, because as you grieve, you heal. Most normal grieving processes, I'm not talking about complicated grief, I'm talking about normal grief. As we grieve, we heal, we recover. The grieving process, what we do when we grieve, how we grieve, allows the grief to slowly, slowly take a back step in our life, go into the back burner a bit. Once in a while, we will remember. And when we remember, the pain can be very sharp. The pain can be, it can be very painful. But it will be, the period of pain will be shorter. The period of memory will be shorter. But the intensity of the pain may not be. You may have lost a family member 20 years ago and still, for a few moments in a year, feel the exact same pain of loss that you did 20 years before because that person was that important. You love that person that much. That is your legacy to the person. Your love has not changed. You are alive. And your memory and your love for that person creates the grief. So to a certain extent, that if I would like to change anything when it talks about grief, I'd like to change this idea that if you grieve, you're sick. Especially when it's a short period of time, you remember this person, it doesn't interfere with your functioning, it doesn't interfere with you managing your life. It is just that once a year, twice a year, you feel immense pain for somebody who's passed on because you love them. And that, to me, is a beautiful thing because what it means is the person who died was that important and was that meaningful and was that relevant that 20 years later, for those few minutes, you can give it to them.
Grieving is loving.
Yes, yeah. It is.
What about, this is coming back to right after it happens, after death happens, staying busy, does that delay the grieving process?
Not quite. You see, when we talk about grieving, there are many, many theories about grief. And one of the theories which, to me, makes the most sense, and I'd like to ask audience to think about any griefs that you have to see whether this makes sense to you. There are two processes that go on in our lives with grief. One is a grieving process, and the other one is the daily tasks, the routines, the busyness. These two go hand in hand. If you think about when you've lost somebody and you are busy, immediately the grieving goes into a back burner. You focus on the work at hand. Once the work stops, then you feel the pain. Then you feel the loss. So for many people, it can be when you get into the car after work, because that's when you're alone. And suddenly you miss your partner, especially if your partner used to pick you up, or the partner used to call you as soon as after, or you used to call your partner after work. You know, you sit in the car, that's when you feel it. Or you go home, you put the children to bed, then you're by yourself and it's your alone time, and suddenly you're grieving again. That's normal. People think it's abnormal because I was just fine 5 minutes ago, why am I crying now? 5 minutes ago you were doing your daily processes. Now you're doing the process of grieving. Give it some time. If you need, what I'd say is at this point in time, give it an hour. Let the grief run its process. As time goes by, the amount of time you will spend grieving will get slightly shorter. And the points between when you need to grieve will be longer and longer. So initially it's like every day I need an hour. Then it'll be once in 3 days. Then it'll be once in a week. Then it goes into once a month. Then it goes, you know, a bit further apart. And that is the normal process of grief. When we are busy, we don't have, you know, we can only focus on so many things at the same time. So that is actually perfectly normal. It is only when we abnormalize the part where we start grieving and we go, oh, something must be wrong with me, something must be wrong with me. That's when we make it wrong. Yeah.
Because it hits us when we are alone, does that mean grieving is, just by its nature, a lonely process? You have to go through it alone?
No. It hits us when we are alone because that's when we allow it to hit us. But if you have a candlelight session. So say you have a whole group and you have a candlelight session and you will see everybody starts, a lot of people start to cry. Then they're grieving together in a group. But that's not something where we allow ourselves to do every day. We don't usually have the luxury of having other people with us. And most of us don't like people to see us cry. Worst, many people don't like to see you cry. So they always want to stop you from crying. And then you feel that your own alone time is shortened. So grieving can be done. In fact, sometimes it is very useful to be done with families. It's just that the way our lives are nowadays, you don't have the luxury of having people around you so much.
Right. For a friend then, or a good, well-intentioned friend or family member who maybe wants to reach out, how do they do so without causing more harm?
Okay, what are we talking about? We're talking about during a funeral, we're talking about later, because the time difference matters.
Yeah, let's talk about the funeral first and then later.
Okay, this is one of actually my, as morbid as it sounds, because I am a thanatologist means I work with death. I do like talking about how do people react in funerals. And my response is usually very badly. Okay, the things people say that are awkward, kind of wrong, kind of not helpful, are numerous. And people just don't know what to do or what to say. So let's just go through a quick list of maybe we shouldn't say. The first one we shouldn't say is, don't cry. Or, cry. Why are you not crying? Both, kind of not necessary. Don't cry is basically, you don't like to see somebody cry. Cry is, why are they not crying? Is something wrong? They don't love the person? They don't miss the person? What's wrong with that person? Both are judgment. People who are grieving cry. They don't cry. Some of them go stone. Some of them try to smile. They are grieving. It is a personal, internal thing. We don't come there to judge people. If somebody is crying, let them cry. If you don't have the time to sit with them, when somebody else comes, back away, give somebody else space. That's a nice thing about funerals. There's a lot of people coming. just don't sit there the whole time and then complain, they cried to me so much, which again, I've seen people do. If you're going to sit there, then say, that's my privilege. I gave the time. You chose to give the time. So the first one is, don't judge whether somebody is crying or not crying, and don't tell people to cry or not to cry. The second one is, are you fine? Is it okay? God.
Like, how are you?
How are you? I'm like, yeah, what are they supposed to say? I'm fine. I'm not fine. You know, there's nothing to say. It's not a question. A platitude does not help. It's going to be okay. When you're saying that to somebody who's just lost their parents, when you're saying that to somebody who's just lost their child, are you kidding? You just lied. It is not going to be okay. It is never going to be okay again. It's going to be a different kind of normal. It's going to be different. They're going to have a different kind of lifestyle. But the life they had with that person, it's over. It's never going to be okay again. And when you go there and you say it's going to be okay, you're lying. And they know you're lying. And they feel it. And then depending on, you know, how people die, like my mom died when she was very young. And I had phone calls from very well-intentioned people going, are you joking?
Hmm. You mean at the news?
Yeah, because they couldn't believe the news. And I was like, why wait until I'm on the phone to ask me that question? Why would I be joking? You know, but it's people expressing their grief, but unwittingly hurting the children. So, I mean, you know, we had questions, and I still can remember some of the really, really hurtful things that they said when my mom died is, oh, you know, you have to take your mom's place. You have to. I'm like, what planet are you all from? And you're like, you're so stunned by the, you know, expectations that people are putting before you can even breathe. Mm. And it was hugely inappropriate. But people don't know what to say. Mm. So that's a sample of what you don't say. What about the sample of what you do say? Human presence. Why are funerals important? Why is it important to go? Because when people die, there's this missing space in their life. Human presence helps to fill that space. Human presence helps people to feel not alone. It bolsters resilience. Positive human presence. Can you trust in your own humanity? Trust that you being there is the most important thing. Deepest condolences. I am sorry. Perfectly fine. I'm here. Very powerful. I'm here. If you want to ask for help and you want to offer help to somebody, ask for specific things. If you ask someone who is grieving, do you need anything? They'll go, no, I'm fine. Are you okay? Yes, I'm okay. But if you ask them, when was the last time you had a drink? When was the last time you ate? When was the last time you had a shower? Then you'll realize that, oh my God, this person hasn't had a drink in 10 hours. They haven't eaten in 5 hours. Nobody thought about that. Every time anybody asks them, are you okay? They go, yes. Do you need anything? No. Because you're asking general questions and people are not processing it like that. People in grief are just not processing. So if you really want to help, number one, give presence. I'm here. Just say, I'm here. I'm so sorry. Give a hug. Don't say anything else. That's all you need to say. And number two, ask specific questions. If you want to offer help, do you need a drink? Don't ask, do you need a drink? Because they'll say no. Ask, when was the last time you had a drink? And then just go and get it. Or when was the last time you ate? And if they have eaten and they have a drink and they're okay, fine. No drama. Mm-hmm. Okay? So those are some of the more open tips which I'm willing to talk about on the air. Yeah. More specific examples, not especially with children.
Yeah. At what point would you say that then grieving becomes destructive? When it's no longer just, you know, an homage or this feeling of love that you give to someone?
Like I said earlier, grieving is two processes. You grieve and you do your normal functioning, your daily functioning, your daily routines. Normal people, daily routines, normal functioning after the funeral takes the huge chunk of their day. Grieving takes the smaller chunk of their day. All right? Basically, you are managing your life. You're focusing on your work is done, your children are done, all those things are done. After those things are done, then you focus on grief. That is a normal process. Abnormalities are when the grief is interfering with the normal process. So basically, you are unable to function on an everyday basis because of your grief. I know examples of wives who've lost their husbands, and they are fine. They work, they look after their kids. But if you mention the husband, they go into grief. And if you give them space to talk about the husband, they go into grief. They grieve, they cry. And after like 10 minutes, they're okay again. As long as they're not thinking about the husband, they're fine. Is their grief interfering with daily functioning? No. Does the grief make other people uncomfortable? Yes. So, but it's not interfering with the daily functioning. They're okay. You don't have to do anything. If, however, that is prolonged and it starts interfering with daily functioning, you know, even when they are working, suddenly they start crying. They bring up their husbands at inappropriate moments, or they bring up their lost ones at inappropriate moments, where, you know, everybody is talking about something, they bring it up and then they start crying. That is non-functional. So it is when the grief is interfering with daily processes, and it's generally in Asian context, it's more than the first year of grief, because the first year of grief is special. The anniversary of the grief is special. It's culturally, it's almost sacred in some cultures to give that 1 year to the person. So after that period, if it comes up, you know, very often at times when it's not appropriate given the setting or given the situation, and it's interfering with daily functioning, that is when you've got a case of probably complicated grief, and the grieving process has moved into slightly more pathological, where it's interfering with your life.
I'll end with this. After the funeral process, after the compassionate leave, after all the logistics have been taken care of, when your colleague or friend comes back to work or goes back to school and you see them around as a good person, as a decent person, a friend or not, do you acknowledge what happened? Do you try to go on as usual, as though it didn't happen? How do you... deal with that.
Here, honestly, it is different for every individual who is experiencing the grief, what they want. And I'm not going to say at that point we can give everybody what they want. But what I can say for me is I try to be genuine. If I see a person and I feel that, look, I need to go and say I'm very sorry again and I need to give the person a hug, I will. If I see the person and I think, okay, everybody needs to be formal, this is not the proper time for it, then I just go with it. I'm authentic to my feelings. And this is perhaps, I think, the best way of dealing with somebody or dealing with a situation where you are faced with, I'm not sure what to do, this person is grieving. We understand we've grieved ourselves. So ask yourself, how would you like somebody to respond to you? And is this an appropriate setting for that response? Do I need to wait for a while? Respond authentically. If you don't feel like smiling when you see the person, if you feel sad, then show the sadness. If you feel like, okay, this is a place where we have to smile and I need to smile, then you smile. But don't be unauthentic to yourself, because that doesn't help. It doesn't help your mental health. It doesn't help anybody else's mental health. So at the end of the day, be genuine and be yourself and just think, how would I want people to react to me? And usually we want people to be honest. Usually we want people to be genuine. So just be honest and genuine. Very hard to go wrong with those two.
Dr. Anasuya, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Coming up at the 4 p.m. hour, consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jamunathan will be on our health and living segment today. If you are facing grief and trauma in your life or other mental, emotional and psychosocial issues, Paul will be hosting a mental health clinic where he will answer all your questions related to mental health. Our phone lines will be open. Call us at 03-7710-9000 or WhatsApp us on 018-789-8899. That's 4 p.m. I hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.